From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And this morning, before leaving on an overseas trip, President Trump implied that Democrats who are gaining ground as ballots are still being counted in Florida, Georgia, and Arizona are rigging the results. And he repeatedly seemed to distance himself from Matt Whitaker, the man he picked to replace fired Attorney General Jeff Sessions, but who critics say is a party loyalist who's repeatedly written and talked about ways to stop the Russia investigation.
I don't know Matt Whitaker. Matt Whitaker has a great reputation, and that's what I wanted. I also wanted to do something which, frankly, I could have brought somebody very easily from the outside. I didn't want to do that. When Sessions left, what I did very simply is take a man who worked for Sessions.
We're also keeping an eye today on the fires in California and the day after that terrible mass shooting. But it has been a big week in Washington. So let's bring in Rick Klein, ABC News political director. Hi, Rick.
Hey, great to be with you guys.
And let's start with what we just heard from the president there. He said he didn't know Matt Whitaker. This is the guy that he just chose to be acting attorney general. Why is he saying that?
Well, he's not telling the truth. He has said repeatedly that he does know Matt Whitaker. We know Matt Whitaker has been in the Oval Office with him. And this was engineered by the White House to have someone at the attorney general's position in the interim basis that he can trust, that he can rely on. And it is just not accurate to say he doesn't know him. What he knows about his views is unclear, but what we know about his views are pretty clear. He believes and has said repeatedly that the Mueller investigation had gone into territory that it shouldn't be at, that the president could not obstruct justice because he has absolute power over investigations, and that he could do anything he wanted with the Mueller probe. So those are the questions that are real now. It seems like he's trying to distance himself from Whitaker now that these questions have been raised.
Well, distance himself because he is aware how Matt Whitaker feels about the Russia investigation, or because he wasn't aware of some of the things that, frankly, people are mocking. He is one of many conservatives who feels the Supreme Court needs to be downgraded in power. He was campaign chair for Sam Clovis, who was called to be a witness in the Mueller investigation. He was a board member of a company accused of scamming entrepreneurs. And there's tape floating around. You are well aware of this, Rick, of Matt Whitaker marketing one of the inventions. This is a special hot tub or a jacuzzi chair.
It's incredible.
It's a unique design that's going to help lots of people that have mobility issues get in and use their hot tub in a safe
manner. So as you know, Rick Klein, last night, the late night host, Jimmy Kimmel among them, had a field day with this. They said the current head, acting head of our Department of Justice is a jacuzzi salesman. He should jacuzzi himself, you know. But people feel this is very serious. So what is the president distancing himself because the president doesn't like to be mocked about choices of his, or because he does know how Whitaker feels about the Russia investigation?
We don't know that, in part because he's not being honest about his relationship with Whitaker in the first place. What's clear is that there's been significant blowback, and we've talked about Matt Whitaker as a possible replacement on a permanent basis. There's questions about whether the Senate would do that in the wake of these revelations. Does not seem to be what you'd want in your attorney general. And separate from that, there's legal questions being raised by none other than Kellyanne Conway's own husband, who is a conservative legal expert, who says that the entire appointment process here was illegitimate because Whitaker was never confirmed to this post by the United States Senate. So there's a big cloud over the Justice Department. Keep in mind what happened. The president fired his attorney general the day after the election and now has someone in charge of the Mueller investigation who's on record as having said that Mueller has gone too far. That's the bottom line. I think the rest has been a distraction from that.
Well, and when he did that, Rick, when he fired Jeff Sessions the day after the election, this is something that we have been talking about for months. And even many Republicans were saying he can't do that. He can't fight. Well, he did. Could Whitaker now just end the Mueller investigation? And would anybody on the Republican side in the Senate stand up to him if he did that?
He would have the authority to at least starve it of its resources or reject anything that Mueller has to say. We heard from a number of Republicans who have said that they plan to introduce legislation to protect Mueller next week. A bipartisan group is making that push. But the flip of that is that Mitch McConnell just said that that won't even be necessary because the president's made so clear that the Mueller probe won't be shut down. I have a hard time imagining that it's politically palatable for anyone to see the Mueller probe shut down. Then again, we've seen a number of the president's loyalists stretch their understanding of the president's powers to kind of fit where the president views his own powers over time.
Yeah. Look, we will move on to the other thing that the president talked quite a bit about as he stood next to a helicopter, you know, and was getting ready to travel overseas. He really accused Democrats in several states of foul play, of, you know, rigging what are now the sort of the counts of the ballots that are surfacing in three very important elections. You tweeted this morning the voting is over, but the battle only intensifies from here. Let's start with Florida. Last night, Florida Governor Rick Scott, whose lead in the Senate race is diminishing as votes are counted, filed a lawsuit against Democratic leading Broward and Palm Beach counties, accusing them of mishandling ballots. Let's listen.
Every Floridian should be concerned there may be rampant fraud happening in Palm Beach and Broward counties.
Look, he provided no evidence, but there has been mishandling of ballots in Broward County, and the president spoke a lot about that this morning on the White House lawn. Your thoughts, what's happening here?
It's an extraordinary charge from the governor of Florida to say that local election officials are committing massive fraud.
Well, isn't it? I'm sorry to interrupt, but isn't it also extraordinary for a U.S. president to say
yes.
that elections are rigged?
Of course it is. Of course it is. And I think highly irresponsible, given that there's no evidence there. But it will have to come out in court at this stage. Keep in mind, what we're talking now is just the count. This isn't a recount. This is not even a re-canvassing.
Right.
This has nothing to do with that. This is just the very messy process of counting votes the first time. And what Governor Scott is saying is that you can't trust these counties to count it honestly. He is saying that they are faking it. They're creating new votes. Maybe he has evidence. He hasn't offered it yet. Neither has the president, who is also, I think, recklessly making charges about the integrity of the vote when there is no evidence to the contrary. This is how votes get counted every year. There are millions of votes that aren't counted until days, even weeks after Election Day. That's the system. That's the process.
Well, and it makes you wonder then if the news networks learned nothing from 2000 and called a lot of races when we clearly still have, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of votes left to be counted. We're looking at the situation in Georgia between Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp, which may go to a runoff. We'll see once the votes are all counted there. In Arizona, Kristen Sinema, the Democrat, has pulled ahead of Martha McSally, the Republican. Votes still to be counted there. Rick, we spent so much time on Wednesday looking at what that election meant. And I feel like a couple days later, the big news of that election is that the Democrats took the House, because that is the change. That is the even though Republicans may have added to their seats in the Senate, that was the case before. This is going to be a big change for the Trump administration to have Democratic House.
That is the big headline. And in fact, I think that headline has only become underscored by the count in the next couple of days. It looks like the Democrats will end up picking up someplace in the high 30s in terms of number of seats. They only needed 23. This is the biggest Democratic pickup since right after the Watergate era, when the Democrats brought in a whole new crop of freshmen. So 40 years since Democrats have had this big of a sweep. And you're right. The one immutable change in Washington, whatever you say about anything else in the votes, is that Democrats will chair the committees. Democrats will have the Speaker of the House. Democrats will have subpoena power, the power to compel witnesses. Investigations will head in an entirely new direction. The president will not have the same levels of protection that he has from Congress in the past.
Yeah. I just want to make one comment, because as I'm listening to this, there are, of course, Republicans and Trump supporters who feel that Trump questioning or fighting back at questions about this midterm election is just what to them felt like criticism of the election of Trump, by saying that there was interference from the Russians. Of course, the difference is that the Russians did interfere in the 2016 election. And right now, we just are not seeing the evidence. But you just mentioned the Democrats are going to be taking the House and have the speakership. Who do you think that speaker is going to be, Recline? Seth Moulton from here in Massachusetts has said he's leading a contingent of new candidates that he helped win, that are new representatives, rather, who he helped win, and they said they would not be voting for Nancy Pelosi as their speaker. Who do you think is going to be the Democratic speaker?
There is no other alternative right now. It is going to be Nancy Pelosi unless or until there is an alternative. And I think a couple of things. One is the depth of this victory, the breadth of this victory, makes it more likely that Nancy Pelosi becomes speaker, because Seth Moulton and his band of outsiders, they may not control the ultimate votes, because the Democrats have enough of a cushion here. I don't think enough Democrats would ever vote against Pelosi to allow a Republican to become speaker. That is not going to happen.
Yeah.
And I think Democrats need Nancy Pelosi to kind of make the trains run on time right now. They need a leader who can unite their conference.
Well, and Tim Ryan, I saw from Ohio, who had challenged Nancy Pelosi before, was on TV the very next morning talking. So maybe he's hoping for it as well. Rick, I want to ask you about one more thing today. We had this mass shooting this week. A lot of family members came forward, talked to the media. This is Susan Schmidt Orfanos, the mother of one victim who was actually a survivor of the Las Vegas shooting and then died tragically in California.
I don't want prayers. I don't want thoughts. I want gun control, and I hope to God nobody else sends me any more prayers. I want gun control. No more guns.
Rick, do you think that there is going to be any appetite for doing that on Capitol Hill with a Democratic House?
I do think that there's an area where Democrats will try to push themselves legislatively. They can unite most of their conference, and a lot of Republicans too, around things like background checks, around like even an assault weapons ban, banning bump stocks. I do think that that will be something that the Democrats pursue early in the new year. Whether the Senate takes it up, whether the president signs off, that's an open question. But man, is that just wrenching to listen to.
Yeah.
And we hear it just about after every one of these shootings, and the national moment seems to slip away. I think Democrats aren't going to let this one slip.
But she was also a reminder of all the shootings we've had, that she could have a son survive one and then die in another. Rick Klein, ABC News political director, thank you so much for helping us round out this another incredible week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sunday is Veterans Day, the day set aside to honor the men and women who have served in America's military. Chuck and Tom Hagel fought side by side in an Army rifle platoon during the Vietnam War. They came back with very different opinions about the war, divided as the country was. Eventually, Chuck became a Republican senator and Secretary of Defense, Tom, a lawyer and professor. Retired Lieutenant General Daniel Bolger told their story in the book Our Year of War, Two Brothers, Vietnam, and a Nation Divided. I spoke to all three last year, and I asked Secretary Hagel first why he decided to fight in Vietnam.
In those days, you, if you were not in college or had a deferment, then you were facing the very real prospect of joining a branch of service or being drafted. Most of the draftees went into the Army. I had gone to three colleges, hadn't done particularly well in any of them, was working. Draft board called me home and said, you got 6 months to get back into college or you'll get drafted. And I said, well, I don't think it's in the interest of any respectable educational institution to take me back. It'd be a waste of time for all of us. When's the soonest I could get on a bus and leave? I left the end of that month in April 1967. I felt some responsibility. I think all of us growing up during the 50s and 60s, when most of us had fathers, mothers, grandfathers, grandmothers in World War II, some obligation to help our country. But it was the right time for me. So that's essentially why I did what I did and why and how it all came together.
Tom Hagel, what about you?
I was in high school, and I got my draft notice, and I passed my physical, and again, I was told that I was going to be inducted within, I think it was 6 months, and was not going to wait around for 6 months, so I volunteered to go right after high school. I was in the Army, I think it was 5 days after I graduated, and in regard to this idea of volunteering, our father, for example, was in World War II, and our uncles and extended family members. And in my mind, it was a matter of basically every generation has their war, and it was our time. So you go in. You do what you need to do.
And what about your opinions about the war at that point?
I knew so little about it that I'm sure I didn't even have an opinion. It was war. The United States says that we have to go there and help out this one country. And I was so young, so unsophisticated, so uninformed that I really had no thought about the right or wrong or the wisdom of the whole thing.
And what about you, Chuck Hagel?
Yeah, I think it was the same for me. You just did what you had to do. If the country said this was the right thing to do, you believed your country, you believed that you could make a difference, and you were expected to make a difference. So I think Tom said it exactly right.
So you're both in Vietnam in 1968, serving in the same rifle platoon during the Tet Offensive. Brutal fighting. You save each other's lives multiple times. I was wondering as I was reading this, what is it like to have your own life at stake, of course, but also your brothers. And I mean, what do you spend more time thinking about, your own safety or the safety of your brother?
Well, for me, it was, you know, I guess you'd call it split attention. Obviously, and you're in the middle of something, you're worried about survival. But in the situation we were in, I was always keeping an eye out for Chuck. He was doing the same for me and, you know, hoping that, first of all, nothing happens. And secondly, if something happens, it happens to you instead of him.
Yeah, I think Tom said it exactly right. And I think also, at least for me, and I think Tom felt this way, that if something did happen to your brother, you were there and maybe you could give a little extra attention or a little extra help or somehow maybe shield your brother from anything worse happening. And I think we both felt that way.
And Dan Bolger, as you were putting this book together, what did you discover about these two guys fighting in the war in Vietnam?
Well, I think the thing that it showed is something we all know, is the importance of family. And family is tied to the concept of service for both of these brothers, not only at the time of the Vietnam War, where they followed the example of their father and their other relatives, as they mentioned, but also through the rest of their lives. I mean, both these men have dedicated themselves to lives of public service. They carried that with them. And that's a great example. I know it's a great example to me, but I think it's also a reason why their story needs to be known.
So, Tom Hagel, how did your experience in the war change the way that you viewed the war?
Well, after I was there for a while, and keep in mind that I was 18 years old, barely graduated from high school, and after a while, I started questioning what we were doing there and how we were doing it. I would, for example, see all of us in our unit head out to situations where we knew we were going to have contact with the enemy, and we'd be going over a bridge where the South Vietnamese soldiers would be sitting there or laying there in hammocks with their families just taking in the sun. And after a while, it made me ask the question, you know, why are we taking the brunt of the responsibility of this war when we have so many of these Vietnamese soldiers who seem to be holding back? Then, of course, the rampant corruption over there. You could buy yourself out of the war if you're in the South Vietnamese Army. I mean, it's legendary, the corruption in the government. And all of that became known over time. And I think a lot of people had the same questions. And I got to the point where I felt, well, you know, I'm torn here. I have my duties. These are my buddies, my brother, are my troops, and I'm going to do what I can to survive, number one, for myself, but also for them. I owe them a duty, even though I hate what I'm doing and I don't believe anymore what I'm doing, but I got to do it for them just so that hopefully all of us can get out of here, because it just seemed like a hopeless task. We would go in, for example, and clear a village out of the Viet Cong and then leave, and then 2 weeks later we'd go back in and do the same thing. Over and over and over again. It was pointless.
Is that how you felt, Chuck Hagel?
No, I saw exactly what Tom saw. I had strong feelings as well. He and I used to talk about it. But when you're in war, you don't let that other dimension that Tom has just noted overtake the obligation and responsibility you have looking out for each other and your buddies. Where it hit me later on more and more vividly than at any time was when I listened to the tapes. In fact, I think I first heard them on NPR back in the 90s, between Johnson and his generals and Secretary of Defense McNamara and members of Congress, when it was clear that our leaders of our country were lying and were deceiving the American people and were costing thousands and thousands of lives in this senseless endeavor. And that's where I certainly turned in a new direction and saw it then as vividly and clearly as Tom had seen it earlier.
But even before that, after you guys got back from the war, you shared an apartment and ended up getting into a fight. The police were called from your disagreements.
Yes. I think that just shows you the depth of impact it had on both of us. We believe so strongly because, quite frankly, it was for both of us a life-changing experience. The two of us that went in, two different people came out. I had so much anger and depression over the whole thing that it just was dealt with in the wrong way. Chuck had just as strong feelings where he was coming from.
Now, we are obviously still at war right now as a nation in Iraq, in Afghanistan.
We didn't learn anything.
Well, that's what I want to ask you. What do you think that we learned any lessons from Vietnam?
Well, one lesson I think that we may have learned is that now we're better at separating the war from the warrior, meaning you can be against the war but still support the people who are fighting it, not necessarily because they want to fight it. They're serving their country. They're doing the best they can, so they deserve our support and our respect, while at the same time we can have open criticism of the politicians who basically lied to us to get us into the war.
Chuck Hagel, what do you think?
Well, I think there are similarities between Vietnam and what we are continuing to experience in Iraq and Afghanistan today. We are now moving into our 17th year in Afghanistan. We're back in Iraq after many years. We're in Syria now. We're in Africa, not in just advisory roles, but in pretty significant, maybe technically not combat roles, but in fact, when you're in these countries and you're in these hostile areas, it is combat. I think those are some similarities that we should have learned some lessons from Vietnam. And I think the bottom line of that, I would define it with this point. The military cannot fix problems. The military can help be part of a diplomatic, a strategic objective. But it is the people in the areas, whether it's Afghanistan, Iraq, Vietnam, have to sort their own differences out and have to take control of their own lives and their own future. We can help. And it's in our interest to help, of course. But once you get so deep into a country that the military is essentially not only advising and working on behalf of a government or a people, but in fact in charge of the institutions and the power behind the ability of a government in those countries to operate, then you're in too deep. And that means to me you've probably not learned the lessons of Vietnam.
That's Chuck Hagel. We also spoke with his brother Tom and author Daniel Bulger about their book, Our Year of War, Two Brothers, Vietnam, and a Nation Divided. Veterans Day is Sunday.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
And we're watching two stories today in California with NPR's Leila Fadel, who's in Thousand Oaks, California. Hi, Leila.
Hi.
And we know Thousand Oaks held a vigil last night for the 12 killed in that massacre at the Borderline Bar and Grill. We heard yesterday that the gunman was a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, had an encounter with police and mental health workers at his mother's home recently. Have we learned anything about his motive?
At this point, no. You know, the FBI is investigating. They're processing his home, his car. He lived in a neighborhood not too far from the bar that he ended up shooting. And it was a very crowded night, Wednesday, college night, country-themed, teaching line dancing. So there's very little that we know about the why, the right. Why this happened.
Well, you also covered the horrendous shooting in Las Vegas, over 50 killed. And we understand this country bar in Thousand Oaks had become a refuge for some of those who survived that. And then you spoke with Mark Orfanos, who's the father of 27-year-old Telemachus Orfanos, who survived the Las Vegas shooting but did not survive the shooting in Thousand Oaks. Earlier in our program, we heard his mother say, "I don't want your prayers. I want gun control." Here's his father talking to you.
When you have 300 million guns in private hands, okay, more guns than you have in places like Yemen and Syria, when you have more guns in private hands at a place like this, there is something seriously wrong.
Oh, Leila, I mean, you know, more on, you know, that interaction and your sense of the feeling in this town.
You know, the town is heartbroken. This was a place that, as you said, a lot of people had gone to seek solace right after the Las Vegas shooting, which happened just over a year ago. Telemachus was among those. He was known as Tel, that went to that festival because he loved country music. And he was actually a little bit of a gun enthusiast, his dad said. Mm-hmm. And so this family just wants something to change because there is one mass shooting after the other, they say. And so their son came home last time. But this time, he didn't come home.
Yeah. This is a conservative area, though. It may be even too soon for people to be speaking in the way these parents feel they need to. But what else are they saying, if anything? I mean, it's just so calamitous.
Well, at this point, you know, last night there were several vigils of people getting together mourning, one hosted by Thousand Oaks where the shooting happened, others at churches, at university campuses. It was college night at this bar, as I mentioned. So among the victims was a college freshman, also veterans. Mm-hmm. And so people got together to mourn. There was also blood drives and a fund has been set up. And the investigation into the why this happened continues.
Well, and while this is going on, California is having new terrible wildfires. One in the north, it's burned an entire town, Paradise. And two in the south, where you are, Malibu, actually issued a mandatory evacuation order, but that's been scaled back a bit. But we have seen homes burn on the outskirts of Thousand Oaks. I mean, they have fire, too.
Right. So as people are praying at these vigils, there was smoke on the skyline and ash in the sky. Alerts coming on people's phones about possible evacuations. Parts of Thousand Oaks were actually evacuated. About 75,000 people under mandatory or voluntary evacuation orders. So not only are they reeling from a day like we saw on Wednesday night where people were killed, but they are also dealing with these fires on the skylines that firefighters are fighting.
And possibly having to leave. NPR's Leila Fadel, thank you.
Thank you.
This week's midterm election showed us that the U.S. is still a deeply divided country. So how does the division of today stack up to other times when America was divided? Joining us now are Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, welcome back.
Hey, hey. Good to be here.
So here we are once again in a divided country. But Brian, it's been like this to some degree all along.
Absolutely. Our country was forged in the American Revolution, and the first question we had as Americans was how to treat the losers. Now, we were helped out because over 60,000 loyalists to the crown, they just left. Some went to Great Britain, but a lot of those people stayed home after the revolution, and Americans were faced with the question of, well, how do we treat them? And the short answer to that was we treated British loyalists who stayed in America pretty well, for sure. There were show trials, but over the course of 2 or 3 or 4 years, it was kind of a forgive and forget, at least if you were a white property owner. And it should be said that in places like South Carolina, they needed those white property owners mm-hmm. because there were a lot of enslaved African Americans there. And that made it a lot easier to forgive and forget if you were white.
Okay, so that was the Revolutionary War. Nathan, what about when we come to the biggest division that I can think of in our history, which is the Civil War?
Right. Obviously, it's a moment that defined the country forevermore. And it's important to recognize that the lead up to the war was one in which you had members of Congress, as our colleague Joanne Freeman pointed out, literally fighting each other on the floor of the House. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if the war began the conflicts in the country. But it's also important to note that the kinds of violence and the division that the country experienced in military fashion was absolutely unprecedented. And it's important, too, to recognize that people began to make an argument for trying to, even after the war was over, heal the country's wounds, possibly even extend amnesty to Confederates. And this, too, was a point of division. Lincoln, for instance, was split from radical Republicans on this count. And there were many people who believed that the way that you effectively make the Confederates Americans again is by making them beg for their citizenship. So they lost their citizenship by virtue of being treasonous. And Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor, was very adamant about wanting Confederate leaders to come to the White House and make loyalty oaths effectively. And many Confederates Confederate generals, believe it or not, did not get their citizenship back until the 1970s. Gerald Ford reconferred the citizenship for Robert E. Lee and Jimmy Carter for Jefferson Davis, who remained unapologetic to the end.
But they got nice license plates before that.
Well, and some would argue that the Civil War never ended to the degree that we are still facing some of the divisions that were really on display then.
I think there's something to be said about how Americans think in terms of, you know, rural and urban divides, or, you know, certainly divides around states' rights. But there are, as we historians know, you know, very real differences, for instance, between the way in which the federal government is involved in protecting civil rights and what existed, obviously, after the rollback of Reconstruction, for example. So, you know, there are a lot of crooked lines between the Civil War and the current moment. But I think it's also important to keep in mind that there were efforts to try to make human rights, you know, broadly understood, part of the country's fiber. And that's obviously what the Civil War was completely about. So if there's anything that feels familiar, I think, to the 19th century, it's the question of to what extent are our concerns about immigration, are our concerns about, you know, schools and their safety, broadly understood as concerns around human rights, and whether or not we as a country are able to speak in broad terms about everyone's humanity relative to the country's own sense of itself, its borders, and, you know, its future.
Brian?
Yeah, I would just say that to me, there have always been these incredible divisions. The distinction is when they explode into violence in public. And Nathan knows well that after Reconstruction, white order was restored at the point of the gun through the first Ku Klux Klan and other armed intervention by white citizens who literally stripped away rights that had been earned by the freed enslaved people. And so we've had episodes where that division and quite often violence that does not go noticed, or in some cases it's celebrated, as in the case of lynchings, are slightly below the surface. And then we've had instances where these are very, very public displays of violence.
Nathan, another moment of division in this country that people might not think about in the same league as what we've been talking about is Prohibition.
Yeah. So the effort to regulate the consumption and the production of alcohol, again, was basically a spark that lit a whole host of other divisions in the country. What ends up happening in the course of the early 20th century is effectively a remarkable mass movement, largely spearheaded by a group called the Anti-Saloon League. And what they were basically responsible for doing was creating alcohol as a wedge issue in local politics and state politics, and then at the federal level. And if you did not back them on this single issue, you were going to suffer the consequences. And there's a way in which obviously this is being fanned by the nativism of the age. There's a very clear anti-immigrant sentiment, particularly directed towards Germans, who are primarily the brewmasters of America. Mm-hmm. But there was also a way in which Italians and Irish immigrants were seen as being distinctly, you know, invested in alcohol and obviously concentrated in America's cities. And so you have rural-urban divides, and you have an anti-saloon league that is very nimble in its own political affinities. So it's drawing allyships with the Ku Klux Klan and the NAACP. It's working with the International Workers of the World and Henry Ford and the major industrialists like Andrew Carnegie, right? It's working with women suffragists. And so their ability to really hammer down one issue and be very open, really ecumenical in their political alliances allowed this to be so effective as a political movement. And it's obviously not until 1933 when the Act Against Prohibition gets rolled back. But it's still a point in which the country's history becomes sharply, sharply divided. One quick quote from someone is very famous in this period, H.L. Mencken, talked about Prohibition as proving, quote, the yokel's congenital and incurable hatred of the city man, his simian rage against everyone who, as he sees it, is having a better time than he is, right? And so, again, there's a sense that somehow where you stand on this issue is where you should stand on every issue, in some cases, even your basic humanity.
I'm against Prohibition personally. I'm glad that it turned out the way that it did. Brian, what about more recent divisions? One of the periods of time that we always talk about when we talk about a divided country is the 1960s.
That's right, Jeremy. And I'm just going to focus in on just one year in the 1960s.
Let me guess, 1968.
You're absolutely right. Once again, you're showing that you don't really need us to talk about history. And this was quite literally a year that was drenched in blood, starting with very high-profile assassinations of Robert Kennedy, of Martin Luther King. Going on in the background was the devastation of the Vietnam War, the daily body counts coming back from the Vietnam War. You had all kinds of urban uprisings. In the wake of King's assassination, over 100 cities exploded in violence. Some of the worst rioting was in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., Baltimore. And again, I think one of the issues is how much of this violence becomes publicly talked about and visible, and what's going on in the background? Because it's right. very important to remember for the whole period we're talking about after Reconstruction.
So I was just at the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, California. We took a tour, and the historian there was saying, you know, what you've been talking about, the assassinations of King and Kennedy, and he said, who on earth would ever want to become president at a time like this? But obviously, Richard Nixon did. I just want to ask you finally then, given all of this history, Nathan, do you think that what we're seeing right now, the division in this country, is how does it stack up compared to what we've seen in the past?
So I think there are obviously going to be ideological differences now that are going to feel resonant with past differences. I think one of the things, though, that has become very clear is that, for instance, you know, things like cultural and racial and religious diversity, we know those aren't going away. And so there's an invitation now, unlike in years prior, to really not make the mistake of conflating homogeneity with unity, to understand that the country can, in fact, be a single country without us all having to be the same. And in some ways, I think that's what's at issue now more than ever before.
That's Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballow, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory, always united. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
If you live in a medium or big city or town, you may take for granted the city and state services, garbage pickup, public transport, or a Department of Motor Vehicles, a place that may make you scream because you have to wait forever to get a license. But what if you didn't have one? In rural America, these services can be scarce. Our next story takes a look at the West Texas town of Presidio, population about 4,000, where just recently the office that gave out driver's licenses closed. And as Marfa Public Radio's Sally Bove reports, people now have to travel pretty far to get one.
It's Wednesday morning, and the sun's just coming up on the driver's license office in Presidio. One by one, cars are pulling into the driveway and pulling right back out.
I heard about this last week, just barely, but I was like, it was just, probably the lady was just off for a couple of days.
That's Maria Lavario. She's here with her 16-year-old son to try and schedule his driving test. He's going to need a license so he can get himself to and from the new job he's applying for.
I come and I see the office closed, so that's not fair.
A small printed sign is hung from inside the glass front door. It says, "We are temporarily closed," and lists the alternatives. The closest office is open 2 days a week, and it's in Alpine, 85 miles away. The next closest, Fort Stockton, is 150 miles away.
I'm a single mother. I work Monday through Friday from 9 to 5 p.m. So gas money and having to get days off of work, it's not, I don't think I'm going to be able to do that.
She says this feeling of frustration is nothing new. The driver's license office in Presidio used to be open 5 days a week. The old hours are still listed there on the door in vinyl stick-on lettering. And it didn't just serve Presidio. People from all of the surrounding border communities come here for driver's license services. But in spring of 2017, the hours got knocked down to one partial day a week, Wednesdays. And sometimes it was too busy to get in. Isela Nunez runs the import-export business next door.
You would think that I'm a dance hall, that there was some social event going on because of the amount of cars that you would see.
When it was open, she says her shop was like a makeshift waiting room for the driver's license office. People standing in line would come in to get out of the heat or the cold or use the restroom. Sometimes they'd even ask for help on their paperwork. And now that it's closed, they're coming in asking what they're supposed to do.
And it is sad. It is very sad because it's like this old gentleman when he asked me, you know, then why do I tell DPS when he stops me? I said, well, tell him to come and open the office and give you a driver's license.
DPS, the Department of Public Safety, is in charge of the driver's license program in Texas. In an emailed statement, a spokesperson for the department explained that intermittent closures happen in rural offices across the state. Before Presidio's office closed, an employee from Alpine was coming down once a week to open it up. She left the job, and DPS thinks it'll take months to hire and train a new employee for the same position.
What is the solution for rural Texas? And is this it?
That's Presidio's city administrator, Joe Portillo. He's been watching this issue in the Texas legislature. In September, an advisory committee was considering a proposal to close 87 driver's license offices across the state. Presidio was on the list. The idea was to redistribute resources to more densely populated areas. But lawmakers argued the closures would unfairly impact rural Texans, and they rejected the plan. At the same time, over the last couple of legislative sessions, lawmakers have made it an option for counties, cities, and towns to provide certain driver's license services. And that gives Portillo some pause.
The intent of the law is good, or at least was another option.
He's worried that rural communities like Presidio might feel like they have no choice but to absorb the position when local DPS offices close, even temporarily.
Well, you just place the financial burden on the county or the municipality, and they already have very tight budgets.
And city-sponsored employees aren't allowed to conduct driving tests, just issue renewals and duplicates. Portillo says that's the main reason Presidio is going to wait it out for the Department of Public Safety to hire someone new.
I'm not saying the solution is going to be easy, and I understand the predicament they're in. I just want them to recognize the predicament we're in.
DPS is aiming to reopen Presidio's office by the end of January. In the meantime, residents are experiencing real-life consequences, like this high school senior, Melanie Leyva.
I just got a ticket for $300-something for not having a license and speeding.
She took driver's ed last year, along with 85 other Presidio teenagers. But she couldn't get an appointment for a driving test before the office closed. Now she needs to find a way to get herself to Alpine or Fort Stockton. But until then, she says she'll keep driving without a license.
I have to, because my mom works, and then I have to take my little brothers to school, and then I have to come myself to school. So I just tried to drive safe.
For people like Itzela Nunez, who runs the business next door to the driver's license office, the closure sends a certain kind of message.
I mean, it seems like rural America keeps losing and losing and losing, and I think the people that make the budgets do not recognize rural America.
A DPS spokesperson says the department will request more money during the upcoming state legislative session to staff driver's license offices across Texas. For Here and Now, I'm Sally Beauvais in Presidio.
I will not complain about the DMV again. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. We'll be broadcasting from the BBC in London next week with a focus on Brexit. Tune in for that. This is Here and Now.